Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
My name is Lauren Mathias, and I am an investigative journalist. And if you are new to Hidden True Crime, we delve deep into the hidden motives of unimaginable crimes and criminals through journalistic storytelling, evidence, and psychological deep dives. If you're curious in understanding why crimes occur, hit subscribe and follow as we delve deep into the darkest recesses of the human mind in order to understand the world and ourselves. While my co-host, criminal psychologist Dr. John Mathias, is preparing to share his thoughts on the case of Abby Williams and Libby German from Delphi, Indiana, I've prepared to tell you everything you need to know before the trial begins later this month in Carroll County, Indiana. And if you are new to this case or you simply need a review, you are in the right place.
Directly to the killer, who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight.
These are the words of Indiana State Police Superintendent Doug Carter in a 2019 press conference. Carter has been front and center in the investigation from the very beginning, a crime committed 2 years before this press conference was held in 2017 in the tiny, close-knit town of Delphi, Indiana. And at this press conference, this 2019 press conference, Carter spoke directly to the unknown killer as he ominously warned them, as well as warned his entire Indiana community, the killer was hiding in plain sight. 2 years earlier, on Monday, February 13th, 2017, 13-year-old Abigail Williams and 14-year-old Liberty German, who went by Libby, were hanging out at Libby's house. The two best friends had spent the night together because of a rare Monday off of school. Abby had brought with her a box of arts and crafts, and that previous Sunday night, they had worked on art projects in Libby's room and practiced softball in the backyard. This Monday, the friends had an idea for an afternoon adventure and decided to ask Libby's big sister, Kelsey, for a ride to a local nature reserve. They wanted to go hiking near the Monon High Bridge in Delphi, Indiana, a heavily wooded trail near Deer Creek, and a popular place to walk and enjoy the scenery. The actual Monon High Bridge was built in 1891 and was an old railway bridge towering 60 feet above Deer Creek. The train stopped in 1987 and the bridge was abandoned. Yet 30 years later, here in 2017, the bridge remained popular for locals to walk high above the creek, take photos, and breathe in the fresh Indiana air, which was exactly what Abby and Libby were excited to do. But what was meant to be a fun day exploring with a best friend would soon become a nightmare that would forever change Delphi. Libby's older sister, Kelsey, willingly took the girls and dropped them off near the Monon High Bridge at 1:30 p.m., knowing that Libby's dad was able to pick them up later in the day, and off the friends went. Abby and Libby eventually ended up walking up onto the old abandoned bridge. The girls were talking and taking photos on Libby's phone, just hanging out, just like typical teenage girls do. Libby even posted a photo to her Snapchat account just 30 minutes after being dropped off at 2:07 p.m., showing Abby carefully walking across the bridge as she wore a solid colored shirt, gray hoodie, jeans, and black sneakers. That 2:07 timestamp forever imprinted in their loved ones' minds, as it was the last time anyone ever heard from Abby or Libby. Later that afternoon, when Libby's dad arrived to pick them up as planned, the girls weren't where they said they would be. Libby's dad called their cell phones and couldn't get a hold of them. He walked around looking for them, calling their names, nothing. He called Kelsey to confirm that he was in the right place and ask if she had heard from Abby or Libby. She hadn't. Police were called and a massive search ensued.
assistance to locate two missing juveniles, Liberty Rose Lynn German, last seen at the High Bridge in Delphi, Indiana, approximately 1300 hours. Second juvenile, Abigail Joyce Williams.
Search crews canvassing the area tried pinging the girls' cell phones into those late evening hours, but with no success. Residents came out to help search the trails and the surrounding areas. National news quickly picked up the story of the two missing friends, and as nightfall swiftly came on that cold February evening, residents using flashlights shouted their names. The sound of Libby and Abby filled the dark sky, along with the hopes of hearing a response, any response, as it grew darker and colder. The search was called off just before midnight, with one member of law enforcement reassuring the media that police had no reason to believe that the girls were in imminent danger and that crews would quickly resume their search in the morning.
Very scary situation right now, and I just want a home.
All right, an update now on our top story. Those two missing girls in Carroll County, the sheriff's office and members of the Delphi area community continue searching for those missing girls in the Delphi area.
But family and friends didn't give up, and they continued to scour the area, calling their names throughout the night. The next morning, the search continued. It was February 14th now, Valentine's Day. And just after noon, when one of the search team members made a harrowing discovery. The Delphi fire chief announced that they had found Libby and Abby, but it was not good. The girls had been murdered, their bodies found less than a mile from where they had been dropped off the day before. Police quickly started being less open with the media, almost immediately, a trend that has continued over the last 7 years since the bodies were discovered. And beyond ruling the deaths a homicide due to evidence found at the scene, law enforcement has remained tight-lipped on any and all details relating to exactly what happened to the two best friends. Police were now focused on finding whoever was responsible. Law enforcement was inundated with tips, but for years, the killer's identity remained a mystery, leaving the entire community on edge. Delphi, Indiana is a small town with a population of approximately 3,000 people. The murder of two young girls in broad daylight in Delphi was unfathomable, and the shock felt throughout its residents was palpable. Law enforcement officers investigating the murders did not mince words in press conferences, vowing to find the killer. And the news of Abby and Libby's murder continued to garner nationwide media attention. One of the most crucial pieces of evidence came from Libby's own cell phone. Police say that Libby was filming a video on her cell phone of Abby walking across the bridge when she managed to capture a video and audio of a man who was also walking along the bridge. Police believe this was their killer. And I often wonder about how Libby might have felt in that moment, knowing that she captured footage of this man as he walked towards them along this old railway track. A bridge is really a dead end with nowhere to go except to go where the man directed them. But it was Libby who bravely captured the haunting footage of the man who infamously became known as Bridge Guy. Law enforcement needed the public's help, and that was when they decided to release pictures of Bridge Guy, not full video, but still photos, hoping that anyone who might recognize the man would come forward. They also released a sketch based on witness testimony from those who were on the trail that day and believe that they too saw Bridge Guy. Police describe Bridge Guy as a white man between 5'6" tall and 5'10" tall, weighing between 180 to 220 pounds with reddish brown hair and an unknown eye color. The grainy pictures that were released showed a white man wearing blue jeans, a blue coat, jacket, and a hoodie. Without any arrests, law enforcement decided to then publicly release an audio clip from that same video that Libby captured on her phone, where a man's voice could be heard saying, "Down the hill." Down the hill. Law enforcement released this new evidence to the public in hopes of generating leads, any leads. And at the time, Police maintained that the video of the man was captured during, quote, possible criminal activity, end quote. Another key piece of information that investigators shared was that they believe the murderer was either from Delphi or was familiar with Delphi, either because he worked there or has other connections. In April of 2019, over 2 years after Libby and Abby were found murdered, law enforcement held that other press conference. And it was at this press conference where ISP Superintendent Doug Carter told the killer that he knew that he was hiding in plain sight.
To the murderer, I believe you have just a little bit of a conscience left. And I can assure you that how you left them in that woods is not, it's not what they're experiencing today.
It was also during this press conference that Carter released more of the actual video that Libby captured on her phone. It was clear that Libby's video remained a crucial piece of evidence. And in this video clip, Bridge Guy is again seen walking along the railway tracks, but a longer clip of audio is heard, this time with the man saying, quote, guys, down the hill, end quote.
Guys. Guys.
Over the years, there have been numerous persons of interest. People caring about solving this case would compare these individuals to the two vastly different sketches released by police to the public. One person of interest early on in the case was a man named Ron Logan. Ron Logan was an elderly man living in Delphi, Indiana, and he found himself at the center of intense scrutiny during the investigation for a number of reasons. Number one, the girls' bodies were technically discovered on his property, just a short difference from the Monon High Bridge where they had last been seen. This proximity alone made Ron Logan a person of interest early on in the investigation.
This is a small town up there in Carroll County and still distraught over the loss of two of their own.
People here in Delphi are cautious tonight about saying too much of anything. Many of them knew these two young girls and they know their families, and they are just finding it still very difficult to talk about what happened. On the outskirts of town, though, where police found the two teens' bodies, people are talking, sharing their disbelief and anger. Against the beauty of the sunshine and bright blue skies Wednesday, it was still hard for Ron Logan to believe the violence visited upon two young teens just out for a hike on a day off from school.
Who would have thought they'd let their children out to do something special that day, take a trip down and it turn out a disaster like this?
For 53 years, Logan's lived on the country road near the trail that leads to the Monon High Bridge.
People walk up and down with their children, and yeah, it's quite a nice little trail on the bridge.
Never, though, has Logan seen anything like what he has this week. The search for an eventual discovery of the bodies of Libby German and Abby Williams.
The area that they were in is very hard to get to. I mean, you can't get there unless you walk there. I mean, so somebody would be walking with them or something.
But what raised even more suspicion was Ron Logan's behavior following the murders. On the day the girls disappeared, Logan actually told police he had been out of town, specifically at an aquarium, which provided him with what seemed to be a solid alibi, right? However, it was later revealed that Logan had actually asked a relative to lie about his whereabouts that day, which immediately made him a suspect in the eyes of law enforcement. And then even more damning information was revealed.
A month after Abby and Libby were murdered, an FBI special agent asked a judge to authorize a search warrant of the massive property where the bodies were found. The property was owned by Ronald Logan, and 13 News was there when officers served Logan a search warrant in March of 2017. The FBI got permission to search the entire property, including Logan's home, garage, his pickup truck, computers, and cell phones. Now we know exactly why the judge granted the warrant. In her request, the FBI agent wrote, "I believe there is probable cause to believe that Ronald Logan has committed the crime of murder, and evidence of that could be found on Ronald Logan's property." The special agent then went on to give plenty of information about why she believed Logan was responsible. We'll get to that in a moment, but first, the warrant request has new information about the crime scene that has not been released before. The FBI agent confirmed one of the victims was missing an article of clothing. There was no visible signs of a struggle or fight. At the crime scene, investigators recovered fibers and unidentified hairs. And the agent wrote, "It also appeared the girls' bodies were moved and staged by whoever committed the murder."
The agent also references the video on Libby's phone, confirming it was 43 seconds long. Up until now, only a few seconds have been made public. That the girls were followed by the suspect on the Monon High Bridge Trail, and that there were no visible signs of a struggle or fight. The search warrant is for the property of Ronald Logan, who owned the land where the girls were found dead.
The FBI agent also said Logan asked a relative to create a fake alibi for him for the afternoon the girls were reported missing. She also said cell phone tower data showed Logan's cell phone was in the area where the girls went missing the afternoon they disappeared. And later that night, cell phone tower data showed Logan's phone in proximity to where Libby and Abby's bodies were eventually found. Investigators also interviewed two women who had been in a relationship with Logan, and both reported that he was physically abusive. One told investigators Logan threatened her and said he could kill her and no one would find her body.
The agent writes a large amount of blood was lost by the victims at the crime scene. Because of the nature of the victim's wounds, it is nearly certain the perpetrator of the crime would have gotten blood on his person or clothing. Authorities also found that two articles of clothing from one of the girls was missing from the crime scene, while the rest of their clothing was recovered. It also appeared the girls' bodies were moved and staged. The agent goes on to say, "Based upon my training and experience, it is common for perpetrators of this type of crime to take a souvenir or in some fashion memorialize the crime scene."
During the search, authorities were looking for any evidence that might link Logan to the crime.
You just cannot believe this terrible thing that happened to the community and the families actually happened here on my property in my backyard.
He told me he has an alibi, buying tropical fish 20 miles away.
Yeah, I was not home during the time that all this was happening. I was in Lafayette.
Yeah.
And I didn't get home till approximately 6:30 in the evening, and then the neighbor stopped to ask for permission to look back here for the girls.
What do you hear on there?
Nothing that I recognize at all. No one. I don't recognize the voice at all.
I asked Ron Logan to repeat those same chilling words.
Down the hill.
And that image of the suspect?
The picture is of such poor quality, it doesn't look like anyone I've ever seen.
However, despite the extensive search and the suspicious alibi, investigators did not find any concrete evidence tying Ron Logan directly to the murders. Ron Logan had a history of legal troubles, including a previous conviction for driving under the influence. As part of his probation terms, he was not allowed to drive, and now investigators believe that this is what prompted him to initially ask a relative to provide a false alibi for him.
Who is safe here or anywhere else anymore?
Ron Logan is now in custody on an unrelated probation violation.
The violation of his probation led to Ron Logan's arrest. Although the arrest was not directly related to the Delphi murders, it definitely intensified the scrutiny towards Logan. Investigators used the opportunity to search his property more thoroughly while he was in custody, hoping again to find any evidence that might link him to the murders. Even Ron Logan's ex-girlfriend thought he could be responsible for the murders of these girls.
Ron's property was right next to Monon High Bridge. He had some pasture, he had some goats and the horses. I moved in with him for a while, and it didn't really work out very well. He was controlling with me. I had to keep the house tidy and couldn't lay down on the couch. It just had to be the way he wanted it. But he wanted me there. It goes a little bit further than me in his life. I'm pretty much a sex tool. Can we stop? Can we?
Yeah, we can stop.
Okay. Yeah. When I didn't want to have sex, he forced it on me. And I was helpless. You know, I couldn't help myself. And when I did get away, he would always draw me back. One day, he had been working on putting a new door on a basement cellar, and I said I wanted to break it off with him. And out of the blue, he hit me over the head with the crescent wrench. And I remember taking off, running to my vehicle, and I remember falling to the ground. And I was afraid he was going to hit me again. So I was able to get on my hands and knees and I crawled away. I got to my vehicle and I was able to leave, and then I felt the blood running down my face. I barely remember the drive to the doctor's office, which is only a few miles to Delphi, and had seven staples put in my head. But I actually had went to my sister's after that. I'm lucky I got out of that situation, but it took a long time.
It really is stunning to hear her tell that story for the first time. She's obviously very, very emotional. And again, she feels confident, Connie does, that the wrong guy may be locked up, which is pretty startling to think about.
Not only that, but Ron Logan had kind of a weird alibi. And from what I remember 7 years ago, I didn't really check out.
So weird. So he claimed to police that he was going to a town outside of Delphi to buy tropical fish, and that he was with his cousin. But we later come to find out that when they looked into this, they talked to the cousin. The cousin didn't back that up. They were never able to clear that alibi, to figure out if it was true or not. And even to this day, it seems like he lied about where he went.
Pretty specific when you're, you know, mentioning tropical fish, and easy to track that. But this is a small community, and, you know, they're not used to having double homicides, especially with kids. So, I mean, I've seen it happen, you know. All right, so what about the property? Like, they did look at his property. They actually did investigate, but I feel like it might have been a long lag.
They did, but it was a month after the murders. So think about it. A month has gone by. There's so much that could have been done out there at that property in that time. A month.
Despite all of this, the searches and the suspicions, still no direct evidence was found connecting Ron Logan to the crime. And he was never charged in connection with the murders. He later died of COVID in 2020. Another person of interest was Keegan Klein. Now, Klein, who is now 30, was an internet catfish who used various fake accounts to chat with underage girls. One of the accounts he used was under the username Anthony Schatz. And according to court documents, police believe the Instagram profile Anthony Schatz was used to solicit explicit pictures from underage females on social media. Not only that, but in a disturbing twist, it was discovered that he was actually chatting with Libby. Not just chatting with Libby, but chatting with Libby on the day of the murders. And he had even allegedly told another girl that he was supposed to meet up with Libby that day. Many people, myself included, had a hard time accepting this as just coincidence, that this online predator happened to be the last person to speak to Libby before she was murdered, and that there was no connection whatsoever. Was it possible that maybe Klein didn't do this himself, but maybe knew the killer? Well, police searched his home less than 2 weeks after the murders. Keegan has never been charged in connection with the case, but he wasn't completely off the hook with law enforcement. During the search of Keegan's home in Peru, Indiana, investigators did find explicit images of children. He was arrested and charged with child exploitation and possession of child. Indiana State Police Officer Christopher Cecil found thousands of images on clients' cell phones in which he used fake personas to persuade girls ages 12 through 18 to send him explicit images or videos. Investigators also testified they identified 11 victims and that they believe that there were even more unidentified victims. Hidden True Crime is prepping to record live podcasts on the road while meeting many of you along the way. We want to connect to all of our gems without language being a barrier. Enter the most trusted language learning program, Rosetta Stone. It immerses you in a language you're learning, and it's available on desktop or app, perfect for on-the-road learning. We're excited to learn Spanish, French, Italian, Korean, and more. Excited to speak, listen, and think in a new language through an intuitive process, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Join with us. Do not put off learning that language. No better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, Hidden True Crime listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. What's one money lesson you wished you had learned earlier? For me, it was how important it was to save for a rainy day. It would have saved me a lot of heartache. Luckily, I learned the lesson and it wasn't too late. Our podcast sponsor, Acorns, makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invest your money for you. And now Acorns is putting their money into your future. Open an Acorns Later IRA and get up to a 3% match on new contributions. That's extra money for your retirement. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client testimonial compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime. Bread is a must-have for quick sandwiches or school lunches, but Dr. John and I are also trying to be carb conscious. So we call the relationship complicated until now. Hero Bread has reinvented the breads that make our meals delicious. The bread is so fluffy, our son approves. It has a texture that rivals traditional bread, but without the carbs. Hero Bread has 0 to 1 gram of net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Plus, it's high in fiber and contains protein. From sweet Hawaiian rolls to tortillas, we are including Hero Bread with most any meal. The tortillas make an amazing quesadilla or enchilada. They have a classic tortilla flavor, but without the carbs and sugar. Taco Tuesday never tasted so good, and they are the perfect fit for our efforts at a healthier family lifestyle. Give Hero Bread a try. Get 10% off your order at hero.co by using code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. Hero, H-E-R-O.co, and use code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout to enjoy your fall favorites guilt-free. In a jailhouse interview in 2022 with HLN investigator producer Barbara McDonald, Klein admits to trying to solicit images from the underage girls, but said he wasn't actually trying to meet any of them in real life. He said, quote, "I don't really know. I was just lonely. You know what I mean? Just talking to people. I don't know why I did it, really," end quote. When he was asked about talking to Libby on February 13th, 2017, he said, quote, "That's what they said. That's what the police told me," end quote. Klein pleaded guilty to the charges, and he was sentenced to 40 years in prison with an additional 3 years suspended. At Keegan's sentencing, he said, "I was depressed and lonely. I knew it was wrong, but I liked the attention. I'm truly sorry to each and every one of them." So now, fast forwarding to 2022, 5 years after Abby and Libby were murdered, many people worried that they would never get justice or that the case was going cold. I was one of them. It had been 5 years, despite law enforcement saying otherwise. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, on October 26th, 2022, A 50-year-old man named Richard Allen was arrested and charged with murdering both Abby and Libby. It came as an absolute shock to everyone following the case, to say the least, but even more shocking to the residents of Delphi, because Allen was a familiar face. He was a family man, a married father who had raised a daughter in the community, and he worked at the local CVS pharmacy. In an eerie twist, he had even printed photographs of the victims for Libby and Abby's families for the girls' memorial. How could someone who had lived among them, someone who had seemingly participated in everyday life in Delphi, be capable of such a heinous crime? Could it be that the words of Doug Carter stated 3 years earlier in 2019 that the killer was hiding in plain sight be so eerily true?
Back then, no one imagined just how difficult this was going to be to solve. It's just an unthinkable crime. And almost 6 years of hunting for their killer, more than 70,000 tips, sketches of potential suspects released by the police, and even a grainy video that was captured by Libby German's cell phone, and the now infamous and chilling recording of a man's voice saying this. We still don't have a whole lot of information on the arrest yet because the probable cause affidavit is sealed. But Richard Allen has never been named as a suspect before. He has no criminal record. He's also being held without bail, which is pretty serious. Police searched his home last week. They dug up his fire pit and they towed a vehicle, but they still won't say what they found. I'm joined now by Lauren Mathias. And Lauren, I mean, I have been working on this story also since 2017. And this just came as such a surprise. I really almost felt as though this is just going to be a cold case for a very long time. Do you have any further information on why this man, why now?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think that question, Ashley, is what everybody is asking. You know, 2017, we're going on but nearly 6 years, and why now? But what's interesting is what I think people aren't talking about is a 2019 news conference. State Police Superintendent Doug Carter at that news conference at that moment said, you know what, we're switching directions. And you know what, this man, this suspect, and he talked directly to him. He said, we know that you are hiding in plain sight. So why now?
Actually, you know what, Lauren? We actually dug that soundbite up. We dug that moment up. And it, again, like you said, this is Doug Carter, the man that you saw holding back the tears today, saying that this was not a day to celebrate, that they have a long road ahead of them. And this was the message in that news conference that he gave to the killer. Let's take a listen.
Directly to the killer, who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight. For more than 2 years, you never thought we would shift gears to a different investigative strategy, but we have.
Okay, so that now looking back, I really wonder what the different investigative strategy was. Did they ever let on? Do we know what they did differently?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. He did say in that press conference, and I love that you had that soundbite because, like I said, no one's talking about this. He did say, we're switching directions at that moment. And he said, this person, he talked directly to the killer. He said, we believe that you're in Delphi or that you work in Delphi. We believe that you're watching, that you're nervous, that we switched directions. That's the day they put out a new sketch, and that's the day they put out the video of him and those words that Libby caught on her phone that were so important to this case. And so it does make you wonder what they learned at that moment and what they've been delving into. You know, they've been so tight-lipped on this case. We still do not know how those young girls died. We do not know how they were murdered.
That's the thing. So this is a thing that they have never revealed. And it's unusual because we usually hear if there's a sexual assault or if there's a, you know, a modus operandi of the killing, just to help maybe tweak what people might know or think about. And they have never done that. Have they ever said why they've been withholding that particular information?
Nothing beyond saying it's about the investigation and we need this information, which does go with that 2019 press conference. It's really telling now, because I think that they did have an idea. And what they knew is that there was someone likely in the community that was nervous and that they needed to be able to have this evidence and what they knew very quiet, very not known, so that they could test the waters with the evidence and see what suspects come up and who knew what. And I think it really benefited.
It's really incredible if you think about it, that maybe in 2019 when he said that and said, we think you're hiding in plain sight, they've had eyes on him for 3 years, just waiting to collect what they needed to collect, just waiting for him to make, you know, one false move. Just a fascinating story. I'm going to have you back as we learn.
One of the earliest and most contentious issues after Allen's arrest was the sealing of that probable cause affidavit, citing concerns over the integrity of the investigation and the safety of witnesses. The decision to keep the evidence against Allen sealed sparked debate and frustration among the public and media, who demanded transparency in such a high-profile case. The defense also pushed for the affidavit to be released, arguing the public access was essential for a fair and transparent judicial process. After several hearings and deliberations, finally, the court agreed to release a redacted version. According to that probable cause that was released, Richard Allen not only put himself on the trail that day in the exact clothing as Bridge Guy, there were witnesses claiming to have seen someone on the trail that resembled Richard, and another witness who claimed to have seen a man walking down the road in, quote, muddy and bloody clothes, end quote. Investigators also said that an unspent bullet found at the crime scene matched a gun that Richard Allen owns. Shortly after his arrest, Richard's defense team released a statement to share what they had said was important information about their client and the ongoing investigation. The statement outlined the following points, and I'll quote these points straight from Richard Allen's defense. Quote, Richard is a 50-year-old man who has never been arrested nor accused of any crime in his entire life. He is innocent and completely confused as to why he has been charged with these crimes. The police did not contact Rick after Libby German and Abby Williams went missing. Rather, Rick contacted the police and voluntarily discussed being on the trail that day. Like many people in Delphi, Rick wanted to help in any way he could. Rick contacted the police to let them know that he had walked on the trail that day, as he often did. Without Rick coming forward, the police probably would not have even had any way of knowing that he was on the trail that day. Rick volunteered to meet with a conservation officer outside of the local grocery store to offer up details of his trip to the trail on the day in question. Rick tried to assist with the investigation and told the police that he did recall seeing three younger girls on the trail that day. His contact with the girls was brief and of little significance. Rick does not recall if this interaction with the conservation officer was tape recorded, but believes that the conservation officer scribbled notes on a notepad as Rick spoke to him. After Rick shared his information with law enforcement officials, he went back to his job at the local CVS and he did not hear from police for more than 5 years. The next time Rick heard from the police was in October 2022, and this was approximately 2 weeks before a contested sheriff's election and within days of a federal lawsuit filed against the Carroll County Sheriff's Office by its former second-in-command, Michael Thomas. In the lawsuit, Thomas claims that he had, quote, made suggestions and offered assistance in the investigation of a high-profile child homicide investigation, end quote. But those suggestions and offers were rejected by the sheriff. Thomas further claimed that the sheriff and others in the department feared the disagreements with Thomas would become publicized as a result of the political campaign for sheriff. Thomas claimed in the suit that he was ultimately demoted and replaced, who later that year, by someone who won the 2022 election for sheriff. And furthermore, Thomas claims he was also removed from high-profile cases. Rick was ultimately arrested on October 28th, 2022, and in the 5+ years Since Rick volunteered to provide information to the police, Rick did not get rid of his vehicle or his guns and did not throw out his clothing. He did not alter his appearance. He did not relocate himself to another community. He did what any innocent man would do and continued with his normal routine. The probable cause affidavit seems to suggest that a single magic bullet is proof of Rick's guilt. It is a bit premature to engage in any detailed discussions regarding the veracity of this evidence until more discovery is received. But it is safe to say that the discipline of tool mark identification, or ballistics, is anything but science. The entire discipline has been under attack in courtrooms across the county and being unreliable and lacking any scientific validity. We anticipate a vigorous legal and factual challenge to any claims by the prosecution and the reliability of its conclusions concerning the single magic bullet. On Rick's behalf, we have argued to have the openable cause affidavit unsealed. Rick has nothing to hide, although it is the burden of the prosecutor to prove Rick's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense team looks forward to conducting its own investigation concerning Rick's innocence. The prosecutor mentioned at the last hearing his belief that others may have been involved in this killing, yet there was no mention in the probable cause affidavit about a second suspect involved in the killing. The defense is confused by such discrepancies in the investigation and will be in a better position to respond as more discovery is received. Rick Allen owned a Ford Focus in February of 2017. His Ford Focus is not in any way similar to the distinctive look of the PT Cruiser or smart car that was described by the witnesses. It seems that the Carroll County Sheriff's Department is trying to bend facts to fit their narrative. Moving forward, it is our intent to scrutinize the discovery as it is received and give the necessary attention to the volumes of tips that we are receiving. To the extent we continue to discover information that points to Rick's innocence, we will offer up this information to the public so long as we are not prohibited from doing so as a result of the recent request by the prosecutor for a gag order or by the Indiana Rules of Professional Conduct. End quote. Months later, another bombshell came as the new documents revealed a shocking twist in Richard Allen's case. The records indicated that Richard had confessed to the murders, and not just once, but multiple times, and during phone calls with his wife, Kathy, and even on the phone with his own mother. Each time he made these confessions, Kathy would allegedly abruptly end the call, and it was stated that after these confessions, Richard's mental health took a severe downturn. He rapidly lost weight, stopped eating and sleeping, and broke his tablet, which was his primary link to the outside world. He also began engaging in unusual behaviors like eating legal documents from his attorneys. There is so much more to this part of the story, and we will be coming back to this, so don't worry. During one court appearance, according to witnesses, Richard Allen appeared almost unrecognizable, a drastic change from the day of his arrest. In response, his defense team requested that he be moved to a different facility. Despite the initial document stating Richard Allen's mental decline happened after his confessions, the defense argued his confessions were made under severe mental distress caused by his protective confinement. Despite the defense's concerns, the judge denied their request, pointing out that Richards was actually receiving better treatment than other inmates in the same facility, which, by the way, was a prison. And this is something else we are going to come back to. But before we get there, we have to talk about a major plot twist in this case. A bizarre 136-page bombshell memorandum filed by the defense. In this memorandum, Allen's lawyers tried to shift the focus completely away from Allen and onto individuals that they claim are followers of Odinism, a pagan Norse religion that has been co-opted by white supremacist groups. They argue in multiple filings that these individuals, not Allen, were responsible for the murders. The defense initially introduced this theory in a motion for a Franks hearing, where they challenged the legitimacy of the search warrant issued for Allen's home. According to the memorandum, back in 2017, an FBI agent disclosed that the bodies of the two victims at the crime scene appeared to have been moved, manipulated, and deliberately staged. Whoa. Now, prior to this revelation in the memorandum, there was really little that was known about the crime scene because no autopsy results or cause of death had even been shared, except there had been some text messages that had been leaked online regarding how the girls were discovered. The text messages allegedly written by Abby's uncle, David Erskine, who had been part of the search crew, and allegedly he saw the bodies and stated in these texts that were circulating online that the girls were near each other, touching, but that they were not bound. That Abby was found clothed, but Libby was naked, with some leaves and sticks covering the top half of her body. Their throats had allegedly been cut. Other than this, there were no solid details until this memorandum, where Richard Allen's defense is now claiming that the murder scene included symbols possibly resembling runes constructed from the sticks and branches, and they argued that these were left behind by individuals associated with this Odinist cult. According to the defense, investigators had previously gathered information linking two groups of Odinist followers to the murders, one located near Delphi and another based in Rushville. They accused the prosecution of concealing a letter from a former investigator who suspected the Odinist group in Rushville had a stronger connection to the killings than Richard Allen, the man charged with the crimes. The defense further alleged that several law enforcement officers and prosecutors had hidden evidence of Odinist involvement. One of the more chilling details revealed by the defense concerned how Libby's body was found. She was discovered at the base of a tree lying on her back. Her left arm was extended above her head, touching the tree, while her right arm lay beside her body. Numerous tree branches were placed in a deliberate pattern on her, with one large branch running from above her head to below her legs. Another branch formed a V near her groin, and a fourth branch crossed her chest, touching the other branches. The defense suggested that the lack of blood near Libby's neck and the tree indicated she was likely killed elsewhere before being dragged to this spot. Abby's body, discovered just a few feet away, was fully clothed, but she wasn't dressed in her clothes. Instead, she was dressed in Libby's jeans and Libby's sweatshirt, leading the defense to propose that she was initially killed while nude and then redressed by these alleged perpetrators after her death. Despite fatal wounds to her neck, very little blood was found on her clothing or body, apart from the area around her neck. This, the defense argued, meant the murderers made an effort to keep her body clean of blood. Abby's body was positioned at an angle with her right leg bent at the knee and placed beneath her left leg. Branches had also been arranged on top of her, according to the defense, forming an asterisk-like shape. One of these branches, they claimed, appeared to have been cleanly cut with a tool, which they say suggested premeditation. Above Abby's head, the defense said, smaller sticks were placed over her hair, mimicking horns or antlers. The crime scene's peculiarities written in this memorandum extended beyond the placement of the bodies. The defense claimed a red F-shaped stain was discovered about 4 feet up a nearby tree, and it was later confirmed to be Libby's blood. The defense claimed the symbol resembled the rune Ansuz, which stands for Odin. In addition, they claimed a rune called Hegel was found on Abby's body, symbolizing hail. Thus, together, the defense argued these symbols could be interpreted as Hail Odin, pointing to a ritualistic motive behind the killings. The defense also said that the prosecution's timeline was implausible. The prosecution suggested that the entire crime had occurred within an hour and 15 minutes, during which time the killer would have had to force the girls down a steep hill through rough terrain and across a cold river before murdering them. But according to the defense, this theory didn't hold up, especially considering how both girls were posed, their clothing removed, Abby redressed with the branches meticulously placed on their bodies. The defense found it difficult to believe that one person, especially someone of Richard Allen's small 5'4" size, could have carried out these steps alone, all while avoiding detection. They also raised questions about the single unspent bullet found buried between the two girls and connected to a gun Richard Allen owned. when exactly was this bullet found? Was it found immediately at the crime scene when the girls were recovered, or was it found days later? The defense argued that the timeline proposed by the prosecution was flawed, and the evidence and witness statements suggested the murders requiring more time than a single person could reasonably manage in such a short window. They also pointed out that the lead investigator publicly insisted there was only one killer, but had privately admitted that it seemed multiple people could be involved. To legitimize their Odinism defense, a potential connection between Abby and Odinism was pointed out. Abby, the defense said, had been involved with a boy whose father was an Odinist. This boy's father, referred to as BH in the memorandum, had social media posts eerily similar to the runes found on the victims. And BH allegedly made references to the crime scene before any details were released publicly. BH even shared a painting of a man believed to be an Odin hanging upside down from a tree in a pose that they say was similar to the positioning of Abby's body. There was also a disturbing meme posted by BH days after the murder, joking about how, quote, real friends, end quote, help dispose of bodies and remain silent. Another person of interest referred to as EF was also mentioned in the defense's filings. EF, who had ties to BH, allegedly admitted his involvement in the murders. The defense added that EF had once asked police if he would get in trouble if his DNA was found on the girls. Both EF and BH's ex-girlfriends allegedly passed polygraph tests where they claim the men had confessed to the murders. The defense noted that several officers connected to the investigation believed in this Odinist theory, but said their opinions were suppressed to maintain the focus on Richard Allen. The defense suggested that Allen's mental health had deteriorated rapidly while in custody due to threats from Odinist members working as guards at the correctional facility where he was held. They speculated that these guards may have coerced Allen into confessing by threatening his family. Look, I've admitted to feeling all sorts of body discomfort, but perimenopause has taken it to the next level. I do not know what is coming next. And if anyone can relate, I recommend Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is a supplement for women experiencing hormonal imbalance or those symptoms of hormonal imbalance, including those going through perimenopause, menopause, even postmenopause. I'm not the only one using it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth is the company that created Hormone Harmony. They use science-backed ingredients to help with those chaotic hormonal changes that happen to many of us throughout our lives. Night sweats, feeling down, or feeling tired all the time. Hormone Harmony can help with these symptoms. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's HappyMammoth.com. Use code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today. Healthcare often blames weight as a moral failing on the patient, but Mochi Health listens. Their founder, Dr. Myra Ahmad, saw providers use shame when discussing patients' hypertension or dismiss medical concerns due to bias and refuse to use safe and affordable medications. She changed this with Mochi Health, their mission to make patients feel heard and understood. They work alongside their patients without shame or blame and make obesity care affordable and accessible for everyone, regardless of insurance coverage. Mochi Health is a holistic approach to weight loss that includes board-certified doctors, dietitians, and medication delivered to your door, including GLP-1s like Ozempic. Get started with achievable results at joinmochi.com. That's joinmochi.com and use code HiddenTrueCrime for $40 off. Does anyone wish that healthy eating was just easier? Like, I don't even want to think about it, but this is why I started using meal kits from Sunbasket. The kits are delivered straight to my door with all of the ingredients and easy to follow recipes. I can choose my own meals, but I actually let Sunbasket create my family menu for me. Again, I don't even want to think about this. They know my dietary requests, carb conscious and dairy free, plus my requests for less than 20 minutes of prep time. On the menu this week, pork lettuce cups, sweet potato chili, and shepherd's pie. The meats are antibiotic-free, the produce from hand-picked farms. Sunbasket also offers pre-made meals with zero prep or mess. They make a dinner faster than takeout and much healthier. Go to sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. Finally, the defense accused the lead investigator of withholding crucial evidence and manipulating facts to obtain the search warrant for Allen's home and vehicles. Another issue raised by the defense was the fact that some of the witnesses, whose initials we just went over, were actually interviewed by investigators, but the recordings of the witnesses were lost.
Let's talk about the defense's claim that exculpatory evidence has been destroyed. They're claiming that 70 days worth of interviews in this case, basically the first 70 days or so of interviews with witnesses, other people in this case, have been destroyed. What was the prosecution's response to that? I just can't even imagine. You go into a case and you're trying to comb through the discovery and boom, all of this stuff is gone from the most important stages, or what could be arguably the most important part of the investigation, the very early stages.
Prosecutors filed a motion in limine to prevent the defense from presenting their alternative theory or mentioning other possible suspects during the trial. A hearing was held at the end of July into August of 2024, a three-day hearing, for the judge to rule on if the jury would be allowed to hear this Odinism defense. And since there aren't any cameras or audio recordings of this hearing, again, I've told you they have remained so tight-lipped. No audio, no video recordings of this hearing. The information that we have here is gathered from witness testimony transcripts and local media who attended the three-day courtroom hearing. Investigators provided a detailed timeline of the crime, first off, asserting that Libby and Abby were abducted at 2:14 p.m. on February 13, 2017, and murdered between 2:30 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. This timeline was partially constructed from data extracted from Libby's phone. He also said that all activity on Libby's phone stopped at 2:32 p.m., adding that there were no further movements or text messages received after that time. The defense said that that wasn't quite true and that Libby's phone had actually pinged at a nearby cell tower at 4:33 a.m., at which time the phone received over a dozen text messages. The defense argued this early morning cell ping indicated that someone turned her phone back on. And because investigators found Libby's phone positioned beneath her body and underneath one of her shoes, the defense argued the girls' bodies had potentially been in another location before being ultimately returned to the area where the bodies were discovered on February 14th, and that her phone turned back on at that time.
Dueling theories about the case from the prosecution and defense were on full display here in Carroll County Court. The prosecution called a blood spatter expert to refute the defense's claims that blood from the girls was painted on the tree in the shape of a rune. The expert testified that the blood was a transfer stain and not painted, but the expert could not say exactly who was responsible for transferring the blood to the tree. It was either Libby German or the killer.
According to the prosecution, they now claim that Richard Allen has confessed over 60 times, which is quite damning. But the defense argues that, quote, the confessions were coerced due to improper policies and intentional actions taken by investigators and prison staff that violated Allen's constitutional rights, end quote, and therefore should not be admissible as evidence during trial. The defense argued in court that following his 2022 arrest, Allen was placed in one of the state's most severe prison environments, specifically cell 107 in the A block of the Westville Correctional Unit. This unit, described by the former warden as, quote, a prison inside a prison, end quote, and is typically reserved for convicted criminals facing disciplinary actions or those requiring close supervision. Despite Allen's lack of any prior criminal history, he was housed in this maximum security facility while awaiting trial. The decision came after the Carroll County prosecutor requested a safekeeping order, citing the county sheriff's concerns about the staff's ability to ensure Allen's safety at the local jail, as well as Richard Allen being on watch. The former warden admitted that he had never seen a pretrial detainee subjected to such extreme conditions before. These protocols included round-the-clock video surveillance and the presence of fellow inmates designated as, quote, suicide companions, end quote, stationed outside his cell to observe him. Yes, fellow inmates, convicted inmates who are being housed in this maximum security facility help to observe Richard Allen. The defense team raised concerns that these suicide companions had violated prison regulations by discussing Allen's charges with him, recording his comments for prison staff, and even sharing them with their own family members. Eventually, the suicide companions were replaced by prison guards who also monitored and documented Allen's statements. While stationed outside Allen's cell, both inmates and guards reported hearing him confess to the Delphi murders. The former warden even testified that Allen had even personally confessed to him. However, the most damning testimony came from Indiana State Police Detective Brian Harshman, who was responsible for monitoring all communications involving Allen during his incarceration. When asked how many times Allen had confessed while in custody, Harshman revealed that there were, quote, 60 plus direct confessions, end quote. He stated that many of these confessions contained details about the Delphi murders that only the actual perpetrator would know, including the motivation for the crimes. Harshman did not, however, provide further elaboration on those specifics. Detective Brian Harshman testified that Allen began confessing to the Delphi murders in March of 2023, shortly after Richard Allen had started reading a Bible in his prison cell and claimed to have found God. He again made it clear that many of those confessions took place during phone calls with his wife and mother. Harshman said that initially his family was in disbelief, but as the confessions continued, the responses shifted to phrases like, quote, they're messing with your mind, and, quote, stop talking about it, end quote. While Harshman presented his testimony, according to those in court, Allen was seen shaking his head in disagreement. Indiana State Police Lieutenant Jerry Holman testified that a fellow inmate said that Allen had not only admitted to the murders, but also disclosed the weapon used. According to the inmate, Allen claimed he had killed the girls using a box cutter, which he later discarded by tossing it into a dumpster outside a CVS pharmacy. Dr. Monica Walla, a psychologist who regularly treated Allen in prison, also testified that she heard him admit to the killings. However, she claimed that Allen's mental state had drastically worsened by the time of these confessions and diagnosed him with stress-induced psychosis, explaining that his mental health was, quote, severely compromised, end quote, when he made those statements. Dr. Walla testified that Allen was suffering from serious mental illness during this period, highlighting extreme behaviors such as banging his head against the wall and consuming his own feces. Dr. Walla gave a detailed timeline of Allen's deteriorating condition beginning 5 months after his October 2022 arrest. According to Dr. Walla, on March 23, 2023, Allen showed signs of severe depression, withdrawing from others, and admitting he wasn't in a sound mental state. On April 4, 2023, Allen was dealing with insomnia and thoughts expressing that, quote, death would bring relief, end quote. April 13th, 2023, his behavior became increasingly erratic, including eating his own feces. He was described as having a, quote, grave disability, end quote, and was forcibly given psychotropic medication. April 21st, 2023, his thinking now had become increasingly fragmented, leading to conversations about his fitness to stand trial. May 3rd, 2023, Allen expressed a desire to confess to the crime. May 18th, 2023, another round of medication was administered. May 23rd, 2023, he was officially diagnosed with stress-induced psychosis. June 8th, 2023, Allen's depression reached its peak and he showed physical signs of distress, such as trembling and weak knees. June 16, 2023, a new dose of medication was provided. Late June 2023, his mental state showed improvement. October 2023, a year into his incarceration, Allen began asserting his innocence. The defense also brought forward witnesses. Dr. Don Perlmutter, an adjunct professor in osteopathic medicine and an alleged expert as well on ritualistic crimes, also took the stand, stating that the crime scene exhibited characteristics typical of a ritualistic murder. Perlmutter testified that she had examined autopsy reports, crime scene photographs, and social media accounts of individuals linked to Odinism, as suggested by the defense in relation to the girl's death. These accounts featured images of runes and symbols. When asked if she had any uncertainty regarding whether or not the girls were sacrificed in a ritual, she replied, quote, "None at all," end quote.
The prosecution argued that the sticks were in an effort to cover up the bodies.
The ex-wife of BH testified in court. She recalled overhearing her ex-husband, who was the father of Abby's alleged boyfriend, implicate another man as Abby's killer. Following this, she claimed her ex-husband threatened her, telling her to, quote, "keep my mouth shut," end quote, or face death. She also stated that BH owned a knife and that he used this during Odinist rituals where he would cut his hands. But probably the most shocking defense witness to me were the former police officers who had previously worked on the case. One of them, former Rushville police officer Todd Click, testified that he believed multiple people were involved in the killings. He suggested that Abby and Libby may have unintentionally encountered an Odinistic ritual on the trail, leading to their murders. Click added that he was, quote, "shocked and confused," end quote, when Richard Allen, rather than one of the alternate suspects, was arrested. A retired detective, Kevin Murphy, testified that EF's sister provided, quote, "very specific," end quote, information that only some present at the crime scene would know. He also recalled a recorded conversation which EF's sister exclaimed, quote, "EF, why did you kill those girls?" end quote. Although EF denied any involvement in the girls' deaths during his interview with detectives, Murphy recounted a surprising moment. After EF agreed to a DNA swab, he asked whether he would be in trouble if the saliva was found on the victims. Allen's defense team also accused investigators of deliberately withholding evidence. They said that BH, an alleged Odinist suspect, was not thoroughly questioned by law enforcement and that the contents of his phone were never examined, despite investigators extracting data from the devices of 101 individuals throughout their extensive investigation.
But none of the law enforcement witnesses could ever place those suspects at the scene with hard evidence like DNA. The defense also tried to blow up the prosecution's timeline of when the girls were killed so they could open up the possibility of a third-party suspect committing the murders. They tried to prove that with cell phone data. Richard Allen got a win today in court at the very end. Judge Gull removed the safekeeping order, which removes him now from the Department of Corrections, and now he's in custody of the Carroll County Sheriff.
In her ruling on September 4th, Judge Gull agreed with the prosecution, stating that the defense had failed to establish a clear connection between Odinism, ritualistic killings, and the specific individuals named in their filings. While the defense objected to this decision, Judge Gull stated that the court would consider evidence supporting this theory if the defense could provide legitimate offer of proof during the trial. She emphasized that, according to case law, such connections must be supported by admissible evidence, not speculation, conjecture, or hearsay. Additionally, the judge ruled that Allen's confessions would be allowed to be heard by the jury. Most recently, the defense filed a motion to allow jurors to visit the crime scene firsthand. Now, this is interesting. We've seen this before when jurors are allowed to visit a crime scene. The best example, most recent example I can think of is the Alec Murdoch case, where his wife and son were found murdered, killed at Moselle, or at the kennels at Moselle, the property that they owned. The jurors were able to go to that crime scene, and many jurors actually stated afterwards that visiting the crime scene helped them. It helped them get a lay of the land. This allowed them to understand the crime just a little bit more, that they were able to understand where Maggie and Paul Murdoch were found dead. They were able to see the dog kennels, and understanding the crime scene allowed the jurors to see the layout of the property. But specifically, it was the defense that asked for the jury to be transported to the Freedom Bridge or the Monon High Bridge and to the site where the bodies of the victims were located, not the prosecution in this case. It's also the site of the old CPS building where the prosecution claims Richard Allen's vehicle was parked between 1:30 and 4 p.m. on February 13th, 2017. So not only is it the crime scene, this is also where evidence was discovered. But unlike the Murdoch case, the prosecution in Carroll County does not want the jury out there. In the prosecution's objection to the defense's motion, they argued that visiting the crime scene would be challenging, stating that the area was difficult to navigate and that the trip would require, quote, a substantial amount of time and resources, end quote. They also raised concerns about the potential intrusion on the private property of two landowners, and they emphasized that the landscape had changed significantly since the 2017 murders, which is interesting to me. Some valid reasoning there. The state also indicated that they planned to present various exhibits, including maps and drone footage, to illustrate the layout of the crime scene, and so the jurors wouldn't necessarily need to go. They continued on saying that any benefit the jury might gain from visiting the actual location would be, quote, outweighed by the dangers such a trip presents to the jury and to the fairness of the trial, end quote. Just recently, and I mean as of October 5th, 2024, one of the defense witnesses, former Rushville Assistant Police Chief, one of the Delphi Odinism theory experts, Todd Click, was arrested. He's been charged with official misconduct, forgery, and falsifying child abuse or neglect information or records. Currently, the trial against Richard Allen is set to begin October 14th, 2024, in just less than a couple of weeks, with jury selection and then opening statements on October 17th. The trial is expected to last 1 month.
And we are now just 10 days from the start of the Delphi murders trial.
And as we first told you last night on 13 News at 6, the total cost of this trial could be more than $4 million.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about this case, as there is a lot of intense debate online. So definitely let me know in the comments what you are thinking. I am planning to go to the trial. And one reason that Dr. John and I have decided that we are going to attend is because, unlike other trials, this is not going to be televised. This is not even going to have an audio recording like Lori Vallow's trial in Idaho. I want to be able to be there to bring you the very latest. No computers, no cell phones are allowed in the courtroom. All I can do is share what I am hearing and what I am seeing. And so we plan to do that. And again, Dr. John is going to bring his detailed analysis to this case. He has been studying, let me tell you. So hit subscribe, hit notifications, because you want to know what we're going to bring next. And if you like this content, and if you like these backstories that I'm doing, please, again, don't forget to hit subscribe, like this video. And if you want more content like this, we have 60 additional bonus episodes on our Patreon account, patreon.com/hiddentruecrime, as well as FOIA documents, probable causes. And over there, we also have a Discord where we have a Delphi Discord where we are talking about this case. So definitely meet us over there as well.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.